Mark 14, verse 8. She has done what she could. She had done what she could. In 1781, William Wilberforce was elected to Parliament. He was the youngest member at that time of the British Parliament. And 4 years later, under the influence of John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace, had once been the captain of a slave ship. After his conversion, Wilberforce thought of leaving Parliament, preparing himself to become a preacher. But John Newton and others convinced him that he should stay in politics. And immediately he began to speak out against the slave trade in the British Empire. In those days, 35,000 slaves were taken prisoner and captured in Africa, and taken by British ships and merchants and sold in England and across the world. Now you can imagine that the British people in England were against Wilberforce. His fellow politicians were against him. Royalty was against him. His family were against him. And he labored for 20 years before he saw the first law passed that prohibited the sale of slaves in England. But he wasn't satisfied. And he labored on. And he labored on to stop the slave trade in the British Empire. Although they could no longer sell their slaves in England, the British merchants and the British ships could go to Africa and take prisoner, go into the village and take those people prisoner and sell them in British colonies around the world and in other countries all over the world, in South America and in North America. And now Wilberforce not only had royalty and the British people against him, he had all the British Empire against him. And it wasn't until 1833, on the 25th of March, that finally slavery was abolished in the British Empire. That was 3 days before his death. He labored for over 50 years, and only saw two laws passed in Parliament. One forbidding the sale of slaves in England, and one forbidding the slaves now in the British Empire. Many people would say, well, that was just a waste. Only two laws in 50 years. But those two laws brought liberty to thousands and thousands across the world. He was like Mary in this story. He did what he could. Now, Bethany was a place where Jesus often spent the evenings and the nights. In fact, he never spent a night in Jerusalem before he was crucified. But at the end of the day, he would go out a little distance to the little village of Bethlehem. And here we have him in the home of a man called Simon the leper. And Mary, we understand, most people see that it was Mary, the sister of Martha, and the sister of Lazarus who had been raised from the dead, brought in a box of perfume and anointed his head. Jesus had been among many wealthy people in his day. And although this was very precious, it was very special, it probably would have cost a whole year's wages to a working man. Yet it wasn't anything really extraordinary great. But yet the Lord said, she hath done what she could. And it was very precious. In a few hours, he would be in the Garden of Gethsemane. And as he prayed and labored there, and the sweat and the blood rolled from his brow, the fragrance of that perfume lingered on. And when they scourged him and put the crown of thorns on his head and spat on him and pulled his beard and whipped his back, there was still a fragrance of what Mary had done. And even as they led him up Calvary to crucify him, yes, the fragrance what Mary had done was still with him. Some of folks think in the Lord's work that you have to be doing something great. You have to be something important. You have to be somebody that's up at the front all the time. You have to do something that's spectacular for the Lord to use you and the Lord to bless you and the Lord to bless your work. But you know, the Lord requires that we do just what we can. Nothing more, but nothing less. Some people think, I'd like to be able to pray. I'd like to be able to preach. I'd like to be a Bible teacher. But the Lord doesn't call everybody to be such. He calls us to do what we can. I want us to think for a few moments briefly about what Mary did. She did what she could. And then I want us to think of where she did that offering and sacrifice to the Savior. And when we think of what she did, and I think of it applied to our own lives and to my life and to your life, there are three things that I want to suggest. Sometimes we want to say something, but we feel speechless. Now maybe you're thinking this morning, if only I could sing like Helen or Little John. I would say that too, but I can't. The only thing I could ever do but take off my shoes and helmet. The only singer in our house was the sewing machine. But you know, the Lord doesn't expect us all to be at the front singing and praying. Some years ago I was on a trip to the Holy Land with some of our ministers. And I can't remember exactly the place that we were in, but I know it was so depressing. There were nuns running all over the place, and there was a man burning incense, and it was everybody was so taken back. And then all of a sudden, the Reverend Trevor Baxter said, "We'll pray." And you know, his prayer just lifted everybody. It was the highlight of that trip to the Holy Land. It was a wonderful experience. And I thought, if only I could pray like Trevor. If only I could pray like that. But you know, the Lord doesn't expect us all to be able to pray at the communion service, even to lift the congregation in a prayer meeting with our prayers. But He expects us to say what we can. It may be just a simple prayer in your bedroom, in the silence of your home. It might be a prayer that's not even uttered physically as you drive along your car on the roadway, but you lift up your heart to the Lord. It may be just a word of encouragement, something that you say, something simple, something little, that can mean so much when you do what you can. Someone said just a few words to me, and the fragrance of those words linger on until today, and it was such a blessing. It was a letter I received. It was in the late 1967. I was living in a little town of the Bogota Acre. God had given me a burden to do something for people who had leprosy. And I had been 7 years now working in the interior, preaching the gospel, but I felt the time had come to move. I had a letter in my hand and I stood there saying, "Lord, should I take this letter to the post office? Should I post it? Is this the time?" Because that letter was a letter to the mission saying I was leaving the interior, leaving the mission station there, the work, and someone would have to come and take my place. I was going to stay in Manas and study medicine. And how could I study medicine? I was in a foreign country. I knew the mission wouldn't approve, so I would have no financial background. How would I ever get into university? And all these things were in my mind. Should I send the letter? And then a little girl came to the door. Her name was Fausta. She and her mother and several brothers and sisters lived at the other side of the river. They were believers. And her mother, Donna Haimunda, sent a little girl. Little girl said, "My mother sent me to tell you that Sebastiana, my sister, can't go to school today because her foot is bleeding so much." Sebastiana and several members of her family had leprosy, and we could do so little for them in those days. We could do nothing for them. And they just became increasingly deformed and disfigured. I said, "Does she want ointment? Does she want medicines? Does she want bandages?" "No, she's got everything." She said, "You need to know this morning that Sebastiana can't go to school because her foot's bleeding." I said, "Thank you." I said, "Lord, it was really you that wanted me to know that. I have to do something." I took the letter to the post office. The lady there, Donna Sonia, she's a very nice lady. So nice that the local priest would leave the church and marry her. But she said, you know, there was a letter came for you last week, and I forgot to give it to you. And here it is. And I took it back home, and I sat down and I read it. I said, Lord, this has just come after I sent off my letter. You have something to say. And somebody said just a little phrase. It wasn't a verse of scripture. Where God's finger points, there God's hand would make the way. Where God's finger points, there God's hand will make the way. And very often I've prayed that down through these years when I felt the Lord's leading in the Lord's direction, said, now Lord, your finger's pointing in this direction, your hand has got to make the way. You know that I went down to Manas. I had to take entrance exams to university in Portuguese language, Portuguese literature, biology, chemistry, and physics. And when I was at Belfast High School, the first year there, I never passed one single physics exam. And the teacher wouldn't let me back in the class the second year. He forbid me to attend his classes. So I knew nothing about physics and nothing about chemistry. I said, Lord, your hand's going to make the way. And of course, I failed those entrance exams. And everybody said, what are you going to do now? I said, I'll get ready for next year's. But God's hand was making the way. There were 40 places in the medical school that year. And when all the exams were over, only 32 people passed, and there were still 8 places left over. And the professors there decided that they would repeat those examinations. And they didn't announce it in the newspaper and the media. Very few people knew anything about it. But there were still 155 young Brazilians just out of pre-medical school, and one dumb Irish man that had never passed a physics exam in his life. And God's hand made the way. And I passed. I was in the medical school last year. I went into the department that deals with the entrance exams, and I knew the professor there, and I spoke to him. I said, by the way, how many times have you repeated the examinations in this medical school? He said, never. I said, oh, yes. They repeated them in January of 1968, for I got in at the second set of examinations. He said, I started working here in 69, and they've never been repeated since then. And I have no history and no record in our books that they were repeated at any time. Because God's hand was making the way. You see, it's just something simple that we say. A word of encouragement. A prayer that means so much. And sometimes you think you want to do something. Or you want to give something, and yet you feel so useless. You want to give something for the Lord's service, but yet you feel so useless. During the years that I was studying, I lived in the city of Manas, and I worked alongside the pastor of one of the churches there. In fact, I lived with the pastor and his family on the grounds of the church. There was a young man in that church, and I'm going to be very kind and just say he wasn't very bright, but he wasn't bright at all. I think he had about 2 gray cells up there, and that would have been all. He couldn't read, and he certainly couldn't preach or talk very well. But one Saturday he said, I'm going downtown to give out a few gospel tracts. And he stood on the corner of 2 of the main streets in the center of the city, and he gave out a few tracts. And someone took one of those tracts in his presence and rolled it up in a ball and threw it on the ground. He said, that's what I think of your Protestant propaganda. And that young man, Jovina, came back very discouraged. He said, yes, I tried to give something, but it was useless. That was a Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, not very far from that corner. It was a broken down house, the wall, windows had been pulled out, the roof had fallen in. It was strewn with litter and with garbage and with rats and filth, but it was the home to the worst criminals in the city of Manas. Drunkards, thieves, robbers, that was their headquarters. And that Saturday afternoon, a young man staggered to his feet and he looked around him. He was filthy, he hadn't shaved, he hadn't washed for weeks. He looked around at all his companions, they were still unconscious after drinking themselves, unconscious. And he thought, I used to have a family. I used to have a home. I used to have a job, but I can't get free from the drink. The only way out is I'm going to go to a bar. I'm going to take a bottle and I'll break it and then I'll push it into someone's face and then I'll hit somebody over the head and then I'll hit somebody again And to stop it all, somebody will pull a gun and shoot me, and that's it. That's the only way I can get out. And he walked out, and he saw a piece of crumpled paper. He thought, maybe that's money that I could buy a drink, and he picked it up. It was that rolled up gospel tract. He looked at the address on the back. He came up there that afternoon, in his filth and his rags and his stinking of drink. He said, can this Jesus save someone like me? And we were able to say he can save to the uttermost all that come to God by him. He had a hard time getting free from the drink. He had a hard time fending his wife and family and reuniting them. And then eventually I moved away to Rio, and he eventually came to Rio with me. His wife and family would join later. When he got to Rio, he enrolled in Bible school to prepare himself for the ministry. I still remember his first night. He was sent out on an assignment. He had to go and preach in one of the churches. And he came back and he said, you know, it was wonderful. There was a man got saved. I led my first person to the Lord. I said, well, tell me about it. Now, Rio de Janeiro is a beautiful tourist city. And one of the tourist attractions, when you go up the Sugarloaf Mountain and the cable car soaring hundreds of feet up into the air, hundreds of meters up into the air, when the car opened in those days, you were met by a band, especially for the children. And one was dressed up as a cat and another one was a rabbit, and they were playing there. I said, tell me about your first convert. He said, well, he's the monkey on the Sugarloaf Mountain, and he gets saved at my meeting tonight. I said, that's wonderful. So your first convert was a monkey. That was great. I was in Manas last year. I was in the airport. And suddenly a man came over and put his arms around me and started to hug me. And I looked, I said, Vicente, is it you? He said, yes, it's me. I couldn't believe it for a moment. I said, what are you doing in Manas? He said, well, I got a call to a church. I'm the pastor of a church here. He said, the only thing I do today, I'm full-time in the ministry and have been for many years. The only thing I do is preach the gospel. And I thought, 34 years before that, of the man that stood on the corner of the street and gave out a gospel tract, and it was taken and thrown into a ball and thrown on the ground. But the fragrance lingers on, for he's still preaching the gospel there in Manas. Through a torn up gospel tract. So you want to give something, but you feel that you're useless. You want to do something, but maybe you feel hopeless. What could I do for the Lord? What could I do for the work in the martyrs? What can I do for the work in Brazil? Cecil Flanagan preached the gospel in the open air many years ago in Bangor. Some of us will remember him. But one night he was asked to speak. He was still a young man, just starting out. He was asked to speak in Hamilton Road Baptist Church. There were very few people there. It was a very hard meeting. He hardly knew what he was saying. The only visitor came in after the meeting had started. And when Cecil was coming near the end of his sermon, that one and only visitor got up and literally ran out of the meeting. And Cecil went home thinking, well, what was that? That was a terrible meeting. But I tried. I did what I could. 40 years later, I was in a conference in the United States. There were 10,000 in the main auditorium that day. They were all Americans. The one sitting next to me turned and said, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from Ireland. Oh, he said, that's a coincidence. He said, I was in Ireland once, and it changed the whole course of my life. I said, well, you better tell me about that. He said, well, I was a young man, I was a Christian, and I was planning on a career in the Navy. And indeed, on my first trip, our boat stopped at a place in Ireland called Bangor. I had 2 hours shore leave, but by the time I'd found the church, the service had already begun. But I went in and I sat at the back. And when the preacher was preaching, God put his hand on me and called me to be a missionary. I looked at my watch. My shore leave was up. I had to get back to the ship as quickly as I could, so I ran out. And I had to run back to the ship, and we sealed at dawn. I was never back in Ireland. But he said when we returned to the United States, I left the Navy. I went to seminary. I worked for 25 years in Ethiopia. I can't go back because of political situation there. And he pointed a whole row of good-looking young African men. He said, I bring these men over here. I put them through Bible schools, through seminary. I send them back as pastors, evangelists to their own people. I said, well, that's very interesting. Do you remember the name of the church? He said, I remember it so well because it changed my life. It was Hamilton Road Baptist Church. And the preacher was a man by the name of Cecil Flanagan. And Cecil never knew it 40 years beforehand in that terrible sermon, that awful hard meeting, as he preached and did what he could. Well, the fragrance lingers on those young Africans because of that meeting. When Cecil was stuck for words, the fragrance lingers on. I remember Dr. Paisley telling me about an open air when he was a student, and that must be over 60 years ago in Barrie. And at that open air, a woman shouted and yelled and asked terrible questions and interrupted the whole meeting. And he tried as best as he could to answer, but when he gave one answer, then she shouted something else and just disrupted the whole meeting. But a couple of years ago, Dr. Paisley was in a meeting in Wales, and a man came up and said, you wouldn't remember an open air meeting when a woman shouted at you and yelled at you. He said, yes. I was at that meeting. I went home, and afterwards I got saved, and our paths have never crossed. 60 years onwards, the fragrance is lingering on. Yes, she did what she could. You might want to say something but feel speechless. You might want to give something but feel useless. You may want to do something but feel hopeless. But we have to do what we can. Think for a moment of where she did it. Bethany simply means house of the poor. And I'm sure it was a poor place where the Lord was in that day. Remember that he was in the house of Simon the leper. Now, in those days, anybody who had leprosy or had was termed as a leper, it may have been a condition, an unclean condition, they had to be segregated from the rest of the people. They were put outside the city. If they ever come into the city, they had to ring a bell and shout unclean. And Simon had been one of those, and I'm sure he hadn't worked for a long time. And Lazarus had been sick and had been in the tomb, and I'm sure that they didn't have any great roughness of money. And then you'll remember that in Matthew chapter 21 and verse 17 and 18 we read, and he left them and went out of the city into Bethany, and he lodged there. Now, in the morning, as he returned unto the city, he hungered. Can you just imagine? The Lord had been in the home of someone lodging. He wasn't out on the mountain praying all night, but he was lodging in the home of someone. And when he left that home in the morning, he was hungry. They didn't know very much about Irish fryers, apparently, for their breakfast there in Bethany. My mother had friends that she used to go and visit, and she'd say, it's one hungry hole. You never, from you went in, you come out, you never even lift a cup of tea. Well, if you had anything in your home, surely you would have offered it to the Lord that morning as he was leaving. It was a poor place. But it was a wealthy place. Simon may have been poor and destitute for many years, but he was wealthy. Lazarus may not have worked for a long time, but he was wealthy and his sisters were wealthy. Now you see, in those days, a person with leprosy was sent out of the city. It could have been many diseases, but it could have been the same disease that we have today, but we don't think it was, but it could have been. Remember the story where Jesus cleansed 10 lepers and told them, go and show yourself to the priest. Now, leprosy begins with skin patches, with nodules, with swellings. And I wonder if those people, when Jesus said, you're cleansed, if those skin patches disappeared, if the nodules disappeared, and they could go to the priest and say, I've been cured of my disease. But one was different. You can cure people today of leprosy, but sometimes they're left with terrible deformities because they've come too late. One came back and thanked the Lord, and he was made whole. I wonder if he came along with hands like that, deformed hands, and limping and one foot full of ulcers and sores. He was cleansed from the disease, healed from the disease, but he was made whole. I wonder, was that Simon, that he looked at his hands and his fingers were restored to their mobility? You see, that's wealth that money can't buy. Mary and Martha, they'd seen their brother buried. He'd been in the grave for 3 days. And then all of a sudden he came back and was restored to them. Can you imagine? We all have friends and loved ones who have been taken from us. Can you imagine if 3 days after the funeral, they come back to the door and they're healthy and strong and say, let me in, I'm hungry, I haven't eaten for 3 days. Well, it's wealth. In the Acre State where I live, it's right at the end, of course, at the Amazon Valley, right up on the borders of Bolivia and Peru. There are many doctors come from the south of Brazil. And they're only there a few years and they buy a farm and then they buy the adjoining land and then they buy a few more head of cattle. And before long they have a big ranch and they have lots of land and lots of property. And they always come to me and they said, now you've been here for 30 years, so you must have a lot of land. I said, yes, I have a lot of land. It's all here under my fingernails or under my toenails. But you know, I have wealth that they will never know. And you in this congregation have wealth. You prayed. You said something. You said something to encourage me. You gave. And you did what you could to put me through my medical training and sent me to the Acre to represent you to treat that disease. In 1963, I went to visit what was still then a leper colony, where people were segregated. People who had leprosy in the early days, they were taken prisoner. And they couldn't leave that colony. There were high barbed wire fences and they couldn't leave because it was thought that the disease was very contagious. But of course it's not. But they were prisoner there. And I remember going into Souza Araújo Hospital there outside Rio Branco. And I walked around and there was a woman lying in a little wooden hut. And she was in terrible agony, as the nerve in her arms were being destroyed by the disease, and that would bring terrible deformity to her hands. And the pain was terrible. And I said to the people there, well, where's the pharmacy? Can't we get some medicine for her? After all, this is supposed to be a hospital. There's no pharmacy here. But don't you have painkillers? Don't you have anti-inflammatory? Don't you have antibiotics? What do you have? I said, we have nothing. There are 500 of us here. The doctor comes once a month, he stands under that tree, listens to radio for about an hour, puts his little radio to his ear, and then he goes away again, and we're left here just to suffer and to become deformed. That was when I said, Lord, help me to do something. I go back there today. There's a road to that place today. In those days, it took us about 5 hours to get there and 5 hours to get back again, but today there's a road, you can be there in a few minutes. But I walk around the wards and there's still some of those people 40, 50 years ago, even 30 years ago, that were sent there because they had the terrible effects of untreated leprosy. And I look at them. Maybe they're blind, they're face disfigured, they have no hands, their legs have been amputated. And then I come out and I'm driving back into town and I look up and there's a billboard. Tall, handsome, young man rerunning for federal MP. I go down the street a little bit, there's another, and he's going for Lord Mayor. I go into church, I hear the pastor preach. I go into the ward, I meet a lovely young lady doctor tending her patients. I meet a man on the street, a young father, and he's telling me all about his family and how he was able to take them on holiday. And I say, thank Lord, that the people in the Martyrs Memorial and the people in the Free Church said something, give something, did something so that I could be here. Because all those people were my patients. Today nobody even knows that they had leprosy. And nobody knows that they once had that disease. If I hadn't been there, if you hadn't prayed, if you hadn't given, if you hadn't did what you did, maybe they'd have been sitting in a wheelchair in that hospital. And that's wealth that money can't buy. I had the opportunity of traveling all around the Amazon Valley to operate on people who had problems with their eyes and with problem with leprosy. But I also traveled to West Africa, to Guinea-Bissau. And I was in a little hospital there, a leprosy hospital just outside the capital. And they brought in a little old lady. She was old and so poor. And she didn't even have a flip-flop on her feet. She was just so poor and terrible. But nobody could speak her language. Eventually, they found somebody who could speak her language. But he could only speak a language called Balantra. Then they found somebody that could speak Balantra and Fula. And then they found somebody that could speak Fula and Creole. So I spoke in English. I asked her a question in English. It was translated into Creole. It was translated into Fula. It was translated into Balantra. It was translated into her language. She answered in her language. It was translated into Balantra. It was translated into Fula. It was translated into Creole. And then it was translated back to Portuguese. And by the time I'd got the answer, sure, it was clear out of my head what I'd asked her. Couldn't remember at all. I didn't have to ask her very much. She was stone blind. About 2 days later, I took the bandage off her eyes. I didn't need anybody to translate when she clapped her hands and shouted and yelled and looked round and she could see. And that, my friend, is wealth. I was walking down the street in the little town of Santa Madureira recently. And a man coming down the street on his bicycle suddenly stopped and called me. And he said, "You remember me?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "I was taken by the hand into your hospital. I couldn't see. And they led me by the hand. And you operated on one eye. And I could see. And it was wonderful. And I pleaded with you to do the other eye, to operate in the other eye. And you said, 'I'll do a bargain with you. I'll have a go at the other eye. If you promise when you get back to your own town, you'll go to Sunday evening service in the church there.'" And he said, "You operated on my eye. And now I can even ride a bicycle round the town. I can see so well." But it's better than that. I went to the church. I fulfilled my promise. And I got saved. And I took my wife and she got saved. And I took my daughter and she got saved. And we're all members of the church. Friends, that's wealth. You prayed. You said. You gave. You did what you could. And that family are still there in the church today. One of the first people that I operated on was a young man by the name of Jose Edges. Jose Edges was about 17, maybe 18 at the time. And he had two hands like that. Two clawed hands. He had that movement. But that's not much use if you want to pick up a pen, if you want to pick up a cup. Now, in those days, we had Miss Emily Gilchrist, nurse from our Castle Dare congregation. And Emily would take him into a side ward there and put him at a table. I can't do it very well, but she would teach him how to move just his fourth finger. And once he had that fourth finger moving just that little bit, then we take him to surgery and we cut off that muscle and bring it back onto the skin of the hand. And then we cut it in four and we pass those little strips onto the hand, put the fingers in a good position, tie that little muscle on again to the base of the hands, and after the plaster's taken off, we tell them, "Now move your fourth finger." And all fingers start moving. And then again, she'll get him to do the same with his third finger. And she'll get him just to be able to move the third finger that little bit. And they take that muscle off, bring it onto the skin, put it under his skin again, divide it in two and tie it under the thumb. And when the plaster's off, we say, "Move your third finger." And he can actually pinch and pick up a pen and pick up a cup. I asked him, I said, "Jose, what difference has the surgeries made?" He said, "In the morning I can get up and button my shirt. I don't have to stand waiting for my mother, 18 years old. He said, "I can do things that I never did before." I was in another state some time later, and he came to see me. He was working there. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm working in an office, and nobody ever knew that I once had deformed hands." I consider that wealth. Your wealth too. Last year I was working in a little village, the banks of the River Juruá. That's right on the other side of the state, the way upriver, near the borders of Peru. And just a little group of houses there. We were using a school, using the school rooms for our consulting rooms. In fact, I put about four desks together and used that as an operating table to do some minor surgery there. But the director of the school called me outside and she said, you know, she was a Christian, said, you see those houses on the other side of the river? There are about a dozen houses on the other side of the river. Well, she said, do you see that one over there? She pointed out to one. I said, yes. She said, we got together, there are few here, there, but there are some of us here, live in this little village, and we're Christians. And we all got together, and we built that house so that we could preach the gospel on the Sundays, and during the week we could meet for prayer and to study the Bible. And she pointed out the roof. And the roof of that little congregation came from a gift from the Martyrs Memorial in Belfast. And every Sunday as the gospel is preached, the fragrance lingers on from your gift. She said, you remember my son? I said, yes. Her son had terrible complications during his treatment for leprosy. We thought he would never be cured. We thought he would never get over his disease. But eventually he was cured. He was left with no deformities. He was left perfect. She said, remember my son? He came to the meetings in that little church. Came to know the Lord as Savior. Now he's gone to Bible school. He's going to be a pastor. And the fragrance. Someone in this congregation is so wealthy as the fragrance lingers on. She did what she could in a poor place. A young man came into my consulting room one day, and I looked at his chart. He was about a week late, and I started to tell him off. I said, now listen, you're supposed to come here on a day marked. You've been a week now without medication. That's terrible. You can't do that. He said, but I want to tell you something. I said, I don't want to hear what you're going to tell me. He said, but I must tell you. I said, I don't want to hear it. He said, but he insisted. I said, I want to hear it. He said, I don't want to hear it. He said, but you have to hear it. I thought he was making excuses about coming late. He said, you remember the New Testament that you gave me? I took it home. I read it. I read the Gospel of John. And in my own home, I came to know the Lord as Savior. In the village where I live, there's a little congregation. I went there and told them. Eventually, I was baptized, and I am helping in the work, preaching the gospel. We did what we could. It was Christmas in Australia. The teacher of a day school taught her children to make Christmas decorations, and they decorated the auditorium. And the night of the Christmas program, the lights were dimmed, and the children's choir came in singing the carols. And each child had a colored candle in their hand, lighting up the hall with different colored lights. When Christmas was all over, the Sunday school teacher thought, it's a shame to throw these lovely decorations out. What will I do with them? And she got out a missionary magazine and she looked at it, and there was a name and address on the back, and she said, I'll send them to this mission. She put them all in a box and sent them off. It was July in Spanish Guinea, and our good sister, the late Miss Emma Munn, had three little African daughters that she took from the bush when they'd been thrown out to die, and she reared them as her own daughters and stayed with them until they were all married. But one day when they were still children, they came to her and they said, do you know that there's no paraffin oil in our lamps? And we have no light tonight. And when darkness comes, we're going to be in the dark. Now, you people here don't know what it is to be in the dark. Because no matter where you are in Northern Ireland, you can always see a light or a glow from somewhere. But when you're surrounded just by forest and all the perils that there are in that forest. Well, she said, go to the old man in the village that sells the paraffin oil. She said, but he doesn't have any. But everybody in the village knew that it was running down, and they've all bought, and we're the only ones in the village that don't have. We're going to be in the dark. Just then a runner came from the coast with some mail, and among it was a parcel. And Emma opened the parcel. She said, I don't know anybody in Australia. What's this? And Christmas decorations in July. What am I going to do with these? And she took the decorations out. The woman had put the half-burnt candles at the bottom of the box. And they arrived the day the paraffin went on. You see, she did what she could. Yes, you want to say something, maybe something small. You want to give? It may not be much. You want to do something? You may feel useless, but yet there's wealth involved, and the fragrance lingers on.